Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Do we need to re-examine how we view the issue of sexual assault and teen survivors? Over the past year, the Fairfax County school system has been in a legal battle over how it has handled accusations of sexual assault brought on by a high school student. That's just the latest, but the county has several questionable cases going back years. Duke Ellington School of the Arts in D.C. is under scrutiny because of allegations against a former teacher. Those accusations also going back many years. But this is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and we're looking into how this difficult issue affects teenage survivors. My guests are Indira Hennard, Executive Director of the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, and Lakeisha Hall, advocate and survivor of sexual assault. Lines are open if you have a comment, if you have a question about this difficult but important issue. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisher, WHUR. Or you can find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. I do want to advise our listeners that some of the details of tonight's discussion may be difficult to hear. Indira, Lakeisha, thank you both for joining the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Thank you.
Indira, before we get into the issue at hand, can we first work on a definition? Share a definition of with us about what sexual assault is. Is it different from rape? Is it different from molestation? Is this a semantical issue? Help us walk through this issue, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that question, Harold. Good to be with you again.
Sure.
I think first, you know, I think you're right on. In order to really have this intentional conversation around sexual violence, we really do need to be able to put some language around it. And so the definition of sexual assault, it is not within this narrow paradigm that we are historically used to talking about, right? Sexual assault sits on a broad continuum. It sits on a spectrum, right? And sometimes people use the words interchangeably, sexual assault, sexual violence, right? But it's any unwanted sexual contact, but it also can include sexual harassment. It also can include stalking. It's a breadth of things that it can include.
Lakeisha, you were assaulted at 16 years old. Could you, and you're how old now, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't mind at all. I'm currently 41. I was sexually abused from the ages of 14 to 16 years old.
Can you give us a little bit more about who the perpetrator was and how you were able to move through this emotionally after this happened? What caused it to stop?
Great questions, and thank you so much for having this important conversation. I was sexually abused for 2 years by a family member who was also a pastor. And I think it's important for me to say that because I feel that a lot of times people believe that someone who could harm a young person or even an adult is often outside the home or like a boogeyman in an alley. And often, very often, people that we trust, people that we know well, people that we're connected to. And so as a young person for 2 years, it was very hard to keep that as a secret, which I had to do to protect people in my family. But the way that it ended was I left home at 16. I ended up starting my adult life fairly early. I started taking care of myself, became a ward of the state, went to college. And honestly, the truth is, you ask how did I heal and move on from that, it seemed to become exacerbated when I got into college because of the heaviness of those memories. I attempted suicide as a college freshman in the dorm. And it was a very serious situation that led me to realizing that I needed help, real help, still, even years after the abuse had actually physically ended, in order to mentally cope and move forward with my life. And so, unfortunately, it's not something that even when you're physically out of that situation that you can escape. It's something that lives within you and in your mind forever, but it's how you rise above it and use it to move forward that can catapult you into a space of victory, which is what I was able to do.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about teen survivors of sexual assault and how we may need to reexamine how we view this issue. If you have a comment, if you have a question about sexual assault, lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Of course, we will be taking your phone calls all the way up until 8 o'clock. You know, Indira, and I think Lakeisha brings a really important point to the floor of this conversation. It's not always some boogeyman with the pointed hat and trench coat in an alley. A lot of times these situations, these sexual assaults happen in safe spaces. They happen, we have the date rape, we have acquaintance rape, we have incestual situations. We have any kind of, we have peers, teen peers, things happening in high schools where, as is the case with the accusations in Fairfax County, where it was a student who accused another student, both of them minors, of this heinous act. Talk to me, Indira, about the difficulty of dealing with the issue of a safe space, and the reality is that this could happen to anyone, not just young women or girls, but also boys.
Right, absolutely. So sexual assault can happen to anyone. It does not discriminate against age, race, sexual orientation. And I think what the last 2 years and the pandemic has taught us is, you know, our children and our youth were home, right? They were under restrictions. Students came back in the classroom. And what we have seen on the ground is that there has been a significant amount of not only disclosures among students in schools, but also sexual assault happening in schools, particularly students committing sexual assault against each other. And so the schools are in a crisis, and they are looking for support in terms of how to build capacity to respond to this, training for their faculty and staff, crisis support, as well as other resources for the students. Some of what needs to happen with our schools is really coming up with policies to address gender-based violence on campus, being able to have those intentional conversations. How are we keeping our kids safe in school? What does that safety look like? And so that's why we've seen most recently on the news about continued increase in sexual assault happening on campus.
So let's talk about that a little bit more. This for both of you. When you're talking about teenagers, and let's say in school, when you discuss inappropriate touching, and this is the semantical thing, in our heads, inappropriate touching versus sexual assault, or inappropriate touching is sexual assault. How do you believe that schools should address this, if you're talking about peers, 13-year-olds and 13-year-olds, and, you know, is this a situation where you call the police? Is this a situation where this needs to be a discussion in the principal's office with the parents? It is such a complex issue.
Right. And so what we have seen, specifically the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, we've had boots on the ground the last few months because schools have been in crisis. And so it's not just students inappropriately touching each other. That's part of it. But it's also harassment. It's also stalking. It's also other forms of sexual violence. And what we are learning and what the kids have told us is they did not get the conversation when they were younger about what is sexual assault, what is safe touch, what is unsafe touch. And having that conversation now, when they're middle schoolers, when they're high schoolers, it's a little bit too late, right? So we really need to begin to talk to our kids around these issues when they are, you know, very little. I think in the schools, there needs to be specific classes geared towards this. Students have said that they want specific classes that are mandatory, that are geared towards this. The faculty and staff have to be trained on how to deal with that because they're overwhelmed too. In terms of what the school can do, each school is different and they're under different jurisdictions in terms of their policies and all of that. A lot has to do also with how the parents choose to respond. There are multiple pathways to reporting, to getting justice, whatever that looks like for the survivor. But first and foremost, when a student is disclosing, we need to support them in whatever way that they're open to and whatever way they're asking for, and not just support them, but also support the family.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts about that, Lakeisha?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm currently an educator in Baltimore, and being a survivor of this has affected me, of course, differently and has moved me to do more even beyond, you know, whatever policy could be. So as a high school literacy educator, I always found ways to infuse lessons in my classroom about consent and what that word meant, what it looked like when it was not honored, and what they should do when it's not honored. And I think it's also important to note that educators are mandated reporters. And a lot of times, those conversations are not held by educators because they don't want to go through that process of reporting. But because I have lived through it and know the importance of having someone report something so serious, I have made many reports in my career of 2 decades. And I have done it unashamed because the work is important. That is a part of being a support and a village to our young people. I don't think we should be hands off on the things that really affect them and then expect them to perform with excellence in other areas. Mm-hmm. And so I personally took that on as a responsibility to have those conversations, as well as I started a mentoring program for young ladies to talk to them in more depth about that after school. So I extensively addressed this with young people in Baltimore City.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about sexual assault and teen survivors. Do we need to reexamine how we look at this critical issue? If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. CeCe calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling, CeCe. What's on your mind?
Okay, my comment, like the previous caller, you know, I was abused. I'm not a teenager. I'm older now, but I was abused, and I was abused by a family member. And I was also abused by someone in church, and, you know, wasn't pastoring the church, but he was preaching. And come to find out, he had abused my older sister. He had actually impregnated her. And he raped my daughter. And it did affect me. Well, I went to college, but I ended up having 2 minor brushes with the law. And then after this happened to my daughter, I was able to get help. And, you know, I told my daughter to go on with her life because she actually left the country for 16 years behind it. She's back here now, but in another state. But I just told her, you know, to go on with your life because, you know, he's going to get his because, you know, he was in church, you know, preaching God's word and all this type of stuff. But he was incarcerated, but not long enough. But I was able to go on with my life, but it does have an effect on your life.
Yeah.
If you don't get help, and my family was so busy keeping dirty, dark secrets, you know, it does have an effect on that person. But my daughter, you know, she went on as well. She went on to college, and now she's getting on with her life, but it caused her to leave the country for 16 years.
Right.
You know, but I just told her, go on with your life.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Cece, thank you so much for sharing what has happened in your family, and I certainly wish you and your daughters continued healing. I do want to talk about what Cece just shared with us, Indira and Lakeisha, because she just handed us a whole stack of issues.
Mm-hmm.
The dirty dark the dirty dark secrets, disclosure, and problems within, you know, the family, the crushing issues that this causes for the health of, you know, the victim. And I want to get into all of that, but I'm going to have to wait until after the break. But before I even take the break, Indira and Lakeisha, I need you both, if you can, to share with us some resources where people who may need counseling or even information about where they go if this is a recent issue for them when they need help. Indira, if you could share with us briefly first.
Yeah, absolutely. The DC Rape Crisis Center, all of our services are free, and we offer individual and group counseling, as well as we operate our 24/7 hotline support. We also support the 24/7 acute response for hospital-based advocacy, as well as community-based advocacy, where an advocate will meet you at any point in the city. People can get a hold of us quickly on our hotline at 202-333-RAPE, and we can connect you to whatever resource you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Lakeisha, any resource you would like to share with us?
Absolutely. First, I just want to share with anyone who's listening that works in education or is school-based, please consult school therapists and counselors for steps that need to be taken if you have to file a report. And while it might be daunting, take the steps to do so, because the child will appreciate it and you'll be saving them from harm. And then also, for people outside of the D.C. area, there is a national sexual assault hotline.
Go ahead.
Through RAIN, which is the Rape and Incest National Network. And that number is 1-800-656-HOPE.
1-800-656-HOPE. Ladies,
yeah.
Thank you so much. We're going to come right back to you after the break. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a bit. If you're on the phone, please stay with us. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. The Original Quiet Storm, hosted by John Mons. That's next on WHUR. This conversation will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we are discussing sexual assault. This is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and we're looking into how this issue affects teenage survivors. My guests are Indira Hennard, Executive Director of the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, and Lakeisha Hall, advocate and survivor of sexual assault. Lines are open, and they will be open up until 8 o'clock at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before I go back to that laundry list of issues that Cece shared with us, I do want to talk about, if you find that you have been assaulted, okay, and And certainly, I'm sure there are varying degrees. Certainly, there's an issue that may be unwanted touching, all the way up to, a violent rape. But either way, Indira, kind of give me the ABCs of what you should do immediately after you are assaulted, and you do want to disclose, you do want to report. And that is such a difficult emotional and in some cases physical issue for victims.
Yeah, so I think first and foremost, each survivor is going to respond differently,
yeah.
Right? One thing I want to make it crystal clear is that we don't compare sexual assaults, right? So whether it was sexual harassment or, other forms of rape, such as vaginal penetration or anything in between, right? We don't want to compare because whatever happened to you that you didn't want to happen to you, it is violent, right? And so survivors have an opportunity to respond in whatever way that they feel most comfortable. So some may decide that they want to seek a forensic exam to collect evidence that could potentially be used to try to bring forth some type of litigation. Some folks may just want support. They may want to reach out for counseling. They may want to tell a friend, right? It really varies in terms of each individual. But what we want survivors to know is that whatever their path to healing is, whatever their justice to healing is, that they are not alone. What we know to be true is that sexual assault, sexual violence is not a single issue because we don't live single issue lives.
But let me, hold on. Let's be honest. And a coworker harassing you at on your job because he asks you out and you say no and he keeps asking. That's a conversation with the boss and the human resources department. That's not a phone call to the police. But a rape, as you said, vaginal penetration, and that's a call to the police. So I understand the advocate's, mindset. You don't compare, but that's not the way the police are going to look at it. That's not the way your HR department is going to look at it. So which brings me back to my question. How, and I know I get, you're not alone, but when it happens, you are. So again, what are the ABCs of advice that you give, let's say, women who have experienced a sexual assault? What do they do first?
Well, again, each person is different, but what could tend to happen is that they will reach out to someone who they feel safe with, someone they can trust, to try to get support, and that support can look a myriad of ways. It can look like going to the hospital. It can look like calling the police and or both. It can look like just having someone with you, right? Sometimes survivors cannot make a decision in the moment because they're still dealing with the trauma of what happened, right? Mm-hmm. So they may not decide to do anything in that moment. They may wait till the next day or they may wait a few days, right? I think, yes, we don't compare, but it also depends on the levels in terms of how each agency, et cetera, defines in terms of their sexual assault policies, right? So each, agency should have policies on gender-based violence, right? That's critical because if something does happen, then they have something to go on.
When you say agencies, what do you mean?
Any type of employment agency should have policies on how they will deal with different levels of gender-based violence mm-hmm. and harassment in the workplace.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. This is the complexity of it. Because in the example that I used, somebody could be harassing you at work or somebody could attack you on the street away from your job. And most survivors as you suggested, may not have the wherewithal to really understand, you know, what needs to be done in the event that they do down the road, that down the road may be 24 hours or 24 weeks or in between or after that, you know, want to pursue some kind of legal ramification. And I think, you know, for our listeners who have not experienced this, you know, this horrific kind of assault, but may need to keep in mind to spread the word for those who understand the reality of this.
Right. And what I will also say, whether or not someone is harassed on the job or they're sexually assaulted on the street, it mm-hmm. still does not diminish the impact that either one of those instances, that either one of those situations will have on the survivor. Because, for example, if someone is sexually harassed in the workplace, you don't know what other forms of trauma that they may have leading up to that, right? They could have dealt with a previous sexual assault. They could have dealt with something in their childhood that exacerbates what they're experiencing, right? So that's mm-hmm. why we don't compare, because even if it was a sexual harassment, that can have just as much of an impact as, to your point, being sexually assaulted on the street.
I do want to talk about that healing process, the counseling process, in a bit. But beforehand, I need to go back to the phone lines. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Leonard calling from Baltimore. Thanks for calling, Leonard. What's on your mind?
I'm a little nervous about even bringing this up because this is a very sensitive subject.
Absolutely.
I know my wife and I, we're kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum. My wife has been harassed at work sexually and received an injury as a result.
Mm.
And instead of actually looking out for her, HR department actually found a way to creatively terminate her in order to avoid a possible lawsuit. And then she was actually, during the healing process, she was actually assaulted by someone who was a member, who was an in-law, while within a family member's home. And it's difficult to be able to support someone like that when you don't know what to do. But on my end, I was actually a victim in reverse because I was actually in a relationship once before where the person that they used to be with utilized allegations like this against me for their child in order to be able to win a custody battle. And even though all investigations came back saying that I was innocent, because of the severity of the charge itself, everyone just completely ignored the evidence and ended up affecting me for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Because I was separated from my own children and things like that. My question is, as far as how to be able to help victims when you've been in a position where you've actually been falsely accused of something, but you still feel bad because you know that this real thing actually happened. But yeah. You also know and have heard things and learned things, like I have going through my process, where there are actually young people who are actually telling each other, if you don't like mom's new boyfriend or new husband, this is what you say to get rid of him.
Yeah. Leonard,
so how do you get cool with that?
Before I have our guests share their thoughts about the many issues that you brought up, how is your wife doing now?
Well, the unfortunate part is that my wife has already have lifelong illnesses that she deals with.
Mm-hmm.
So all that did was exacerbate everything. So when we first got married a while back, I had to learn her triggers.
Yeah.
So I knew not to approach her from certain angles. I knew not to have her anywhere where she didn't feel like she had a way out to escape.
Uh-huh.
I had to be patient until she was able to be comfortable around me, yeah. Knowing, okay, this is my husband. He's supposed to be in this space.
Right.
And she's had to teach me some of these things. The only thing I knew to do was not ask the details. Whenever she felt comfortable talking, I just let her talk and I don't ask questions. That's the only thing I knew to do, and the rest has just been kind of learning as I go.
Well, I salute you, you know, first of all, for doing your level best to be a loving and supportive husband, you know, as she, you know, moves through this difficulty. But I'm going to keep quiet and have our experts share, Lakeisha. You know, first of all, your thoughts about what Leonard is sharing in trying to help his wife deal with what has happened to her. And then, you know, please, both of you ladies, please, you know, don't hesitate to chime in. I do want to keep him on just a little extra, because I think that all of the issues that he brought up, as difficult as they are, these things happen quite a bit, I would imagine, Lakeisha.
Absolutely. It definitely happens often. And I, too, just want to say thank you to the husband for how he has stepped up in this space, because it is a very difficult space to be in for any spouse to know that the person that they love has been harmed in any way.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredibly difficult for my husband to understand my path of life. And honestly, with the right spouse and with that understanding of that there is hope and that it's a lifelong healing process involved, it is possible for the two to move forward victoriously, but it is not going to be without challenge, of course. And one of the things that I think is important for people who are in the space of supporting a spouse to know is that you have to take the healing process day by day. So one day a survivor could be really high and feeling great, and the next day they could be really low. And to the outside world, that could look unstable and look like you still need support and help. But the truth is, it's just a survivor trying to balance all that should not have happened to a person but did. And one of the best things that a person who loves a survivor can do is listen, offer that the love and support they may not receive outside of the spouse or partner, and then also just keep in mind the resources that we shared earlier, making sure that your spouse has access to therapy, has access to other sources of connections like circles where they're allowed to talk about these types of things and spaces with other survivors, also looking into things that your spouse or your partner is passionate about. I'm an artist, and I use art to, you know, cope with difficult things. And so inviting them in that space when you see that they need that space, and not becoming frustrated if you feel that they're taking too much time in that healing journey and process, because sometimes it can look like that as well, where you might want to be more connected and attached to that person. They might be spending a lot more time just connecting with themselves, which they're going to have to do in order to successfully and truly resume the relationship with you, because we haven't even delved into what that looks like sexually, what that looks like emotionally for that person, engaging with another person who loves them. It is so, as you mentioned earlier, very complex. We're really just grazing the surface of this right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Your thoughts, Indira?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, what we know to be true is that there is no straight path to healing. And I want to thank you, sir, for sharing your story, because what it really highlights is that when someone is sexually violated, it doesn't just impact the individual, it impacts the community, it impacts the family. And so it's really important that if you are someone who has a loved one who has been sexually assaulted, that the loved one also gets support, right? And they are what we call secondary survivors, because they are supporting their loved one. They are also taking in that trauma on a secondary level. And it's important that they have a space to process so that they can continue to support their loved one.
What should Leonard do about, I know certainly we've been talking about teenagers, but I don't want to forget this other issue that he raised, that, you know, for someone who is, you know, dating someone who has children. And what he said is frightening, that the mother may find the man that she's dating to be a wonderful person, but the children, for whatever reason, may not, they may be jealous of the time that mother is spending with this person and decide to level a false allegation. How might someone protect themselves from something like that? Or can you? Lakeisha or Indira, whoever wants to jump in.
Well, I mean, I think I'll just start out by saying, listen to your children, right? The percentage of individuals who give a false report, it's like less than 5%. If children are feeling uncomfortable around an adult, whatever that may look like, it's important to listen to them, right? Because we hear too many times where children have told someone, children have had signs that something is happening, and adults have not listened. And so I think first and foremost, if your child is telling you something, that you need to take that seriously and you need to listen to them.
Yeah. Leonard, thank you so much for sharing with us and bringing up these really important issues and to continue to cover your wife in the loving way that you have been. I thank you for your time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure thing.
I was really hoping I'd been able to ask one. Because I'm actually dealing with trauma myself, and that's the point I'm trying to look for help for. Because I understand that she said you need to listen to your children.
Yeah.
And we absolutely do. But the problem is that more than people realize, and I didn't understand any of this or didn't believe any of this stuff going through it myself, is that more than people realize that there are a lot of times where the outside parent has an influence on something that may be going on. And for me, this actually took away a year and a half of my life that I spent just trying to get to court. And I lost time with my own children. And I still deal with trauma when even walking past a courthouse or being anywhere where there are, you know, someone has like a child. I'm on an elevator and somebody gets on and a child gets on. There's nobody else around. I am extremely nervous and panicky that somebody, that something is going to be accused of me that I didn't do again. Mm-hmm. I still have the proof that I didn't. But as I think it was Indira said, people believe that it's so rare for someone to say something that's not true, and we need to take it serious anytime somebody says it and investigate.
Yeah.
And my case, it's not. And in too many cases, people that are telling the truth, they don't get investigated. They don't get help at all.
Right.
But then there's also the reverse. And I don't know where to look for help for myself.
Indira, let me see if Indira can suggest something, because, again, this goes back to the healing piece that I do want to drill down on a little bit more. But your thoughts about the counseling piece for someone like Leonard.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely encourage you to get the support that you're needing. There are resources out there, mental health agencies that can help you deal with the trauma of, you know, going through the justice system. So definitely I encourage you to do that in D.C. There's a free mental health bank that supports all types of trauma and crime. And so that would be a great resource in D.C.
Mm. And he's in Baltimore. Lakeisha, your thoughts about whether or not there may be some resources in Baltimore?
There is a local agency that I support called Turnaround Inc. I think that agency could be a one-stop shop for both you and your wife, and I'm hoping that you can find some agencies there. They serve Baltimore City and county residents.
Turnaround Inc.
And what I will also say that a lot of mental health agencies are still doing virtual telehealth services. So even if you are in Baltimore, you still may be able to access resources in D.C. and or Virginia and, of course, Maryland as well.
Okay. Leonard, as I said, you know, we salute We salute you, you know, your marriage and your healing process. Thank you so much for sharing with us tonight.
Thank you.
Sure. I do want to talk, I want to get back to the original discussion as it relates to teen survivors. If, let us say that if you have a teenager, your child, who has suffered at the hands of someone who had committed a sexual assault, let us say that you want to, as a parent, jump right to this, address this, and I'm talking about the mental health piece, Indira. What's the first thing that a parent should do? Because I can only imagine how frightening this can be, not only for you as a parent, but also for your child, your teenager.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that, you know, the first reaction a parent would want to do is to get help for their children, right? I think first and foremost, parents have to listen to their children and see what they want to do in that moment, right? So if a teenager, if a child comes and says that they've been sexually assaulted, they may not want to engage in counseling right then and there. They may not be able to engage in counseling right then and there. And that's okay. So I think that's important to note. Sometimes people wait to engage in counseling where they are more healthier on a mental level, where they can really engage in it, because sometimes trying to do it right when it happens, or right after it happens, you know, sometimes people can't do that. But if parents are looking for support regarding, you know, younger children or middle schoolers or teenagers, you know, there's tons of resources. Specifically in D.C., there's the D.C. Children's Advocacy Center, Safe Shores, and that's a specialized national center. They operate off of a national model in terms of how they support kids and parents who are going through sexual abuse. And then other agencies, including the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, we serve youth and young adults. And so when teenagers and other youth and parents are ready, they can access whatever resources they need.
So here's the thing. You said that they may not be ready right away. So then a year passes, and you're still worried about your child because they don't want to deal with it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to address it. 2 years pass. They don't want to address it. At what point is there intervention, because you know how it is affecting them? Your child has been changed by this. Lakeisha, you spoke about this when you spoke about what happened to you. So how do you help someone, particularly your child, when they don't want to revisit this even for the sake of their own healing?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to note that children, teenagers, they process differently, right? So parents may want to force their kids to go to therapy, but when they get in the therapeutic session, parents aren't going to be there, right? So
right.
They may decide not to engage, right? So again, each survivor responds differently, and there's not a right or wrong way, and the healing process looks different. I think it's important to uplift that sometimes people go through their healing process and never step foot in a counseling room, right? That happens a lot, and that's okay. They may not be ready in the immediate or a year or two, but at some point they may decide that they are ready to have a conversation and ready to have some support in really processing what happened. It really does depend. And, you know, parents, I encourage parents to get support for themselves. right? Because part of what may be happening is, in addition to wanting to support their child and wanting their child to get the necessary help, they also may feel helpless, right? And so they may feel like that may be the only thing they can do. And so the parents need to process how they're experiencing it and what's happening for them.
Lakeisha, your thoughts about that, about the time and healing and counseling?
You know, I do have some thoughts. It might stray just a bit from what you originally asked, but I think that we are living in a society now where our parents need just as much help as the children. I grew up in a household where there was a lot of trauma in my family, and so when I finally came forward with my story, I wasn't believed. And so while it, and as an educator, I've heard my story repeated back to me too many times to count,
mm-hmm.
where a child or a young person has said to me, I told my mom, I told my dad, they didn't believe me. And, you know, because of the trauma that the parent experienced, they can't even receive what the child is sharing. And so it's like generational trauma perpetuating itself within the family. And as much as it sounds nice for our parents to want to jump in and help young people, that's not happening as often as we might think. There are parents out there helping their children, of course, but there are a lot of parents out there in denial because they're trying to also continue to deny what could have potentially happened in their own lives.
So help me with something, because obviously we need more Lakeisha Halls. But because we don't have enough Lakeisha Halls, you said you've had young people repeat your story back to you as their own horrific experience. But because there is you, what do you do when, if their parents aren't listening, having the advantage of them talking to you is part of that healing process, is it not?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'll be honest, I take advantage of the relationship that I have with them too. One, I am very open and honest with my story with adults just as I am with young people, especially in high school. And I share with them because a lot of the young people look up to me. So I'm like, look, I have been where you are. And that hits differently than just someone telling them to get help, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they already seeing me in a place where they think they potentially can't be because of all that they've been through. And so that gives them a bit of hope. And then I use, you know, the rest of our relationship to kind of encourage them to allow me to take them to the counselor to tell their own story to the counselor versus me just making a report. Or I talk to them. Who are the people in your life that you trust? Who can you talk to right now that you feel would have your back? And then using their language, not being so, teachery,
yeah.
that they can't connect to me in that moment. And then also allowing them the space to take the time to tell their story. I think sometimes we're so eager and anxious for them to get it out. I'm waiting patiently. I'm giving you the space that you might not have gotten outside of me. And I'm going to hold your hand through the process. And then even maybe having that conversation with the parent myself. Like,
yeah.
this is what your child shared with me. What would you like to happen next?
Well,
you know, giving them the opportunity.
I apologize for cutting you off. I've got to end there. But we do need more Lakeisha Halls. We do need more Indira Hennards. And I want to thank both of you for supporting the survivors of sexual assault and speaking with us tonight.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, April 11th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.